Hi, and welcome to the 90s Podcast, an aviation podcast. I'm Matteo, a former Mirage 2000 fighter pilot, currently flying the Airbus A330 as a commercial pilot in Asia. In this podcast, I will interview pilots and entrepreneurs, talking about flying, careers, and commitments. From military pilots, commercial aviators, aerobatic junkies to influencers, we will go through their unique journey in a one-on-one interview. Together, we will identify the lessons learned of their careers and the future plans they are looking forward to achieve. If you like this podcast, subscribe on iTunes, Google Podcasts, Deezer, or Spotify. You can as well follow me on Instagram, on my professional account, 9Gs Consulting, and click on the link for any inquiry. And now, let's stop cheap talks. Squeeze and get ready for the G-Load. Today's episode special guest is Louis Luxor Malux. He's a former French Navy fighter pilot. He did an exchange program in the US Navy flying the F-18. He is as well a former Royal Canadian Air Force fighter pilot instructor. He is currently a commercial pilot flying for a major career in North America. Here is a quick highlight of this episode.
When you're going for the career, everything is overinflated. So when you're going to be touching, it's going to be very, very hard touch. You're really going to feel it. That's what happened. So my first career trip, I will always remember that. It's like a car crash, really. And not for the sensation, but for the noise. It's like metal against metal crashing to each other. I really thought I broke everything. On my first trip, I said, fuck, they're going to be mad at me. Do we have to eject?
And now, without any further ado, Louis Luxor Malux. Hello, Luxor. Thank you for coming on the 90s Podcast.
Hey, you're welcome. I'm very happy to be there with you.
Yeah, very happy as well. So, Luxor, you've been flying the Super Étendard, the FA-18 for the US Navy. You've been flying as well for the Royal Canadian Air Force and now for the commercial aviation. But first of all, can you tell us where do you come from and how did you get to aviation?
All right. Yeah. So I'm coming from Orléans. So it's south of Paris. It's nowhere close to the ocean. It's close to Tours for the aircraft, for the fighter position. But that's not the reason I went to the to flying job. I came to the flying job because of a funny thing. And we're in sixth grade in France. They're starting to ask me what I wanted to do. And guess what? In the summer of, I was in 1986, I think, I just saw Top Gun. And for fun, just to make it fun, I just said, I'm going to be a fighter pilot in the French Navy. I have no clue what aircraft they were flying at this time, but I thought the Tomcat was awesome. So I said, that's what I want to do. It was a joke. And every year, the same joke was coming when they were asking me what I'm going to do. When I ended up in the 10th grade, that's where I realized that actually it could be a pretty fun job to do. And I started to work only for that and starting to get very, very focused on being a fighter pilot for the French Navy. After my high school, because I knew there was the military world and none of my parents were military, I wasn't sure if I'm going to be able to live in the military like that for a full career. I went to a military school for my my first year after graduation of the French baccalaureate in Brittany National Militaire. I did my work there. And in order to become in the Navy. So one of the questions will be, why the Navy and why not the Air Force once you get into start to be there? So reason for me was like, I wasn't sure if I'm going to make it as a pilot. That's really what I wanted to do, but I wasn't sure. And the good thing of the Navy is if you fuck it up as a pilot, at least you can do something else very operational. So it's true that in the Air Force, there were some commando stuff, and that was very interesting by commando position as well. But there is also the French Navy commando, which was something I was looking for. So that's what the main reason for me to go to the Navy is I could be on the deck of a ship if I need to. I could be a commando or I could be a pilot. That's what I really wanted to do. So I did the exam to get there in 1996. I passed the exam, and I went to the Naval Academy in Crozon, Lanvéoc, Poulmic, for 3 years. So 3 years of an engineering course. When I was able to also fly a little bit, like there is a club of the French Navy, I was able to get my, not my license, but at least my solo check in the French Navy on the rally over there, and I was the only one of my generation to do that. So I was kind of motivated, because to fly in the Navy, to fly in the Crozon in the winter time when you're at school, it's gray every day with no ceiling, so it's very hard to do some VFR flying over there. So every weekend I was waiting for my turn to do a flight, and I finally did all the way to my solo. So I would say 20 hours in 3 years, but that was more than anybody else. And then at the end of that 3 years, we did the selection, and I was part of the 15th guy selected to go to pilot in my generation of 1996. And then started the work in the, so I left the Navy side, i.e. The sailing portion of it, to go to Saint-Provence. I did 1 year in Saint-Provence in 99. And there I went to do the ground school and then the selection on the Tucano. So I flew the Tucano like the direct in France. At this time, they were only doing Tucano. That's what I did, only Tucano. After 3 months, I was selected to do the advanced course on Tucano, which I did between September and December of 2000. And out of those 15, only 4 were selected to go to Meridian, Mississippi. In Meridian, we were 4 of us, and we flew for 4 to 5 months a T2 Buckeye, ugly aircraft, but fun as hell. It looked like a frog when you look at it, a twin engine, but you can do everything you want with this aircraft. It was amazing, like a tail slide, spin, stuff like that, and get flames coming out. It was so much fun. So we did that for 4 or 5 months. And also it was the first time for us to actually start to work in English, and especially in the US. So you have to imagine, like, you never really flew in English first. And the first thing you're doing is, because the US, the way they teach it, it's the first thing you're going to do is you're going to learn to fly in IFR situation. So IMC situation, instrument rules. So your first flight in the aircraft, you're behind the hood with the one radio UHF, where with the first time you're flying with a G-suit, as well as the helmet, and the guy in the front speaking with a very, very sick accent from the south of US. When I was, I think on my first flight, I thought that I was still shooting the approach in Meridian, Mississippi on the Taycan, where actually I was already in Pensacola shooting the approach. That's how bad it was for me. But after 2 or 3 months of English, we were able to make it up, the level of English starting to increase, starting to understand how it works in the pattern as well in the Navy, because it's slightly different from everybody else in the world. You can get all the way up to 10 guys in downwind, so you have to find your interval when you're going to turn. If you don't know where you are, you're going to cut in front of somebody, you can be sure of that. So we learned that, we're able to do it, and then at the end of the T2 Buckeye, we transition on the T-45 Goshawk. We did our course again, and that was 9/11. So I was in the US for 9/11. So that stopped the training for a while. And at the end of that, we got qualified in February 2002 on the carrier. So first carrier qualification on T-45, first 10 cat shot and trap on the USS Harry Truman. Then we did a little bit of ACM at the end of that, and we received our wings. So U.S. wings and Navy wings at this time. Yeah. That was it for my Meridian, Mississippi.
How was the first career operation for you?
First of all, something that not a lot of people knows, but when you go to the carrier for the first time, you're by yourself. There's nobody in your backseat. So when you go to the carrier, you're by yourself. Nobody wants to sit behind you anyway.
It's too dangerous.
It's too dangerous, and I don't want to be that guy anyway. So yeah. You're by yourself. So the way they do it is, for a month before, you actually practice. So you do what they call the FCLP, field carrier landing practice. And for kind of a month, or 2 or 3 weeks at least, every day, maybe sometime twice a day, you're going to do 1 hour of a landing and touch and go. So you're going to do touch and go out of touch and go, trying to fly the ball, the mid ball, the lens that's going to help you to do the glide pass. And also trying to respond to the order of the LSO, the landing ship officer. That's going to give you the right for lineup or come left if you're not lined up properly for the carrier. So it's kind of a working the confidence of both of us, your ability to fly, obviously, and to stay on speed and on the glide slope and line up, but also for the LSO, that's going to bring you on board of the carrier to know that you're actually answering and to his order when he's ordering you to do something. And the first one, that's what happens. So your first one, you're by yourself. You come at usually it's a flight of four. So it's a four ship. The leader is bringing you to the carrier, to the overhead break. And then you're by yourself downwind and you try to make your first trap. The first two or three go are usually bolter or wave off. So you can practice your first final turn. And then they say hook down. And that's going to be your first trap. And the first trap, that's where it's starting to get messy. Because everything at this point, you know how to do it. You've done everything. You've already done it. You already fly a jet. You already fly the ball. Yeah, it's a carrier, but you don't really look outside. You only look at the ball and the lineup. That's pretty much it. You're looking and just responding to the voice of the guy. So you know how to do that. But what you're not ready for is to be taxiing on the deck of a carrier. Also, something you cannot imagine is when you do that every day, you do it with the oleo of the and the tire of the aircraft being at the on the ground position. When you're going for the carrier, everything is overinflated. So when you're going to be touching, it's going to be very, very hard touch. You're really going to feel it. And that's what happened. So my first carrier trap, I will always remember that. It's like a car crash, really. And not for the sensation, but for the noise. It's like metal against metal crashing to each other. I really thought I broke everything. On my first trap, I said, fuck, they're going to be mad at me. Do they have to eject?
That's violent.
That was really violent. And then the next thing you look in front, and there's this yellow dog, the guy that need to make you taxi out of the alley so the next guy can trap behind you. He's making some weird signal with his hands, and he really, really seems to be pissed off. So you need to hurry up, and your leg are flaky and shaking, and it's very hard to taxi. Yeah, so the taxiing is the worst part for me. Then right away, they do they refuel you on the deck, and they put you to the catch out, and there you go again, and you're going to do that. You're going to do three trap and catch out per day, and it's a three-day process usually, and you get your qualification.
During that time, when you do your catch out and your landing on the carrier, does your IP stay overhead, or does it practice as well?
The way it works is if the IP's got the gas, it can stay. And if the pattern is not too full, it can stay and can also do some catch out as well. So it can increase numbers of catch out. But that's not the priority. So usually they do that at the end of the period. Like, so when everybody's starting to get their 6 to 8 traps, starting to get more comfortable, usually the guy are staying at the end and they're doing some extra landing for themselves. But no, normally they just drop you off at the carrier and they go back to shore so they can bring back the next three to come at the carrier.
It's kind of multi-training for a single IP.
Yes, exactly. You just wait in your aircraft and they come in, he lands, he refuel, and boom, we go again with another four jet going.
Yeah, very dense.
It is. Well, you had imagine you had a full carrier only for you guys for a week. So
yeah,
usually it's a class of 10 in Meridian plus another class of 10 in Austin, Texas. So it's 20 guys to qualify. So you have 1 week for the T-45, then you get 1 week for the F-18, 1 week for the Viking at this time, 1 week for the F-14. So the carrier is dedicated for a month or 3 weeks to do only carrier qualification. It does nothing else. So it's very intense, yes.
Yeah, the pattern is full.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, great. So after Meridian, you came back to France and flying the mighty Super Étendard. Can you describe it? Your first flight, because it's a single seat, no twin seat, so no IP. So very, very nice feeling, I think.
It's a different way. So when I came back, I went back in May. There is a little bit of delay. It's 2002. We just started the operation in Afghanistan. The French carrier was there since December, and they just started it. So most of the Super E are already on the carrier. They just shut down the F4. Rafale is still not there, so it's only Super Étendard. So all of the Super Étendard that we're going to be using to train us are on the carrier, basically. So when we came back, I did 4 months or 5 months on the 57S on Falcon 10. So I did a qualification on the Falcon 10 as the first officer, basically, doing some liaison flight for the Navy in Landivisiau. After those 4 months, the carrier came back, the jet came back, and we were able to start the Super E. So Super E, like you said, single seat, no dual seat. You do 10 hours of simulators. Then you do one startup with the IP and outside of the aircraft linked with you with the radio. helping you out to make sure you're not going to toast the engine on your first startup. When the engine is startup, it lets you go and you go for your first taxi, and it's a basically a rejected takeoff. So you taxi all the way to the old short, you request the rejected takeoff, and you just line up, you go full power, you go all the way to 100 knots, and then you abort your takeoff. You taxi back, and that's it for the day. And then the next day, you do your first flight. For first flight, it's actually a flight of two, but the IP is flying on your wings for the whole flight. So you line up on the middle of the runway, and the IP is lining up on what you let you give him on the side of the runway. Basically, you're going full power. He's going full power as well, and he's doing an operational takeoff basically out of you with a full power aircraft, and he's trying to follow you. Make sure you're retracting the gear and you're not getting supersonic towards him, like, basically. And then you go. And at the end of the flight, you're starting to fly a little bit of a formation flight, and you come back for your first landing. And that's the dicey part. I will say everything else, it's pretty easy. I mean, it's just an aircraft. As long as you have some speed, you put some power, it's going to climb, it's going to fly, so you can get away from the ground. It's not very dangerous. The issue with the Super E was hard to land. It was a little bit of swept wing. So when you get on speed, which will be for the Super E, if I remember well, was close to 9 to 10 AOA. So you're pretty cocked up for sweep wings. You're close to the stall. Like a normal aircraft, you usually land with 1.3 of VS. The Super E, you land it at 1.1 of VS.
Even landing on the runway?
Yeah, you always try to land on speed. You also have some very, very bad brakes, so you don't want to land too fast either also. So you have to be on speed, and you fly the AOA on final and on the final turn. So we cheated a little bit. So on the first, instead of being at, I think if I remember well, the speed for computation was kind of, depend on your weight, obviously, but the roughly at 9 AOA, well, you were at 125 to 127 knots. And so when you were doing your first landing, the guy was saying, okay, I'm going to be on your wings on the outside of the turn, but please be at 130, 135. So on the AOA, we have the AOA indexer. So it's not only the readout of the numbers, it's actually a color state. So it's either green, orange, or red. Basically, you wanted us to be in the orange, i.e. slightly fast.
Yeah, for him to ease the formation flying.
Exactly, and also to make sure that, like, if you forget to put back the power a little bit because you want it to descend, you're not going to start to stall the jet. Because when you fly at this speed, it's I don't know, if you've flown a floaty, it's the same type of approach. So you're cocked up, you're on your AOA, so you have an attitude of the aircraft, and then you fly the glide slope only with the power. If you reduce the power, you're going to start to descend on the lower glide slope. If you add power, you may be able to catch it up a little bit. But you never touch the nose. So the nose is cocked up, you don't touch the nose anymore.
So you flew the Super E, then you flew it in operation as well. Can you describe your first operation for us?
It was mostly Ricky for me because I was a young section lead in Afghanistan. So I did two missions at the CAS as a wingman, and I did the rest of the mission were section lead for Ricky flight. So the Super E can also do Ricky, and I was taking old school Ricky with the AP-40 and as well the SDS with the numerical camera.
Yeah, did you have any bomb dropped?
Not on this one, no.
Not on this one?
No, not on this one, no. Afghanistan has always been very, very, very quiet when I was there. There was always a lot of change in the ROE, so it was very active. 1 month before we showed up, and when we were showing up, all the rule of engagement were very, very tight. So there was no, they only have a chance to drop on this one. No. And after that, went back, and it was the end of it. 2006, that's when I joined the US Navy for my first tour as an exchange.
Yeah, so you've done the PPE tour as an exchange pilot in the US Navy, flying the FA-18 Hornet. First of all, my first question would be, what is transitioning from the Super E to the F-18 Hornet? It should be a slap in the face.
Yeah, I won't say it's a slap in the face. I will say it's more an eye-opener. Like a Super E is very, very intensive to fly. You keep on trimming when you're doing something at 100 feet above the water for a strike at sea. You don't have time to do anything else, basically. And it's very, very hard to do the radar at the same time, but you still have to do it. So the scan and the way you fly on the Super E was very, very active. Mm-hmm. You go to the FAT, now everything is slightly faster. You get a little bit more of information with the raw gear more advanced, the radar more advanced, all the air-to-air that's going to come with it. But because you were on very hard aircraft to fly before, it's actually not that hard. It's easier to fly. The aircraft fly by itself. So all this amount of, I will say, processing time that you were using to fly the jet, now you get it available to do something else. So I really enjoy the F-18 actually.
Yeah, I can imagine. How was it to just to discover the Fox 3 air-to-air mission at the time?
Yeah, so that was the hard part for me. And not only the Fox 3, I will say everything, like the BFM as well, basic fighter maneuvering, the fly-by-wire, or introducing some nice maneuvers. Like you can't do that with normal aircraft. Those type of maneuver, that was the game changer. So the way it works, it's you do what they call an IPUG. So they train you, and I did a full qualification, like if I was a young Navy pilot. So I did a full year of qualification, 6 months of qualification, not a full year. Then after my 6 months, I went to do an IPUG to be able to instruct on the F-18. After my BFM, I was able to do some basic BFM on the F-18 as a student. And when you need to instruct now, it's another story. You need to be better than just to be able to move your jet. You need to be able to understand what's happening. So all the basic flying using the radar, stuff like that was okay. But when it was starting to be very dynamic, and the distance also you're fighting, I need to get some adjustments. So the Navy was awesome. The US Navy is really, really awesome for that. Because I was struggling a little bit and you need to practice to get better at it. They just say, yeah, you know what? We're going on debt in Key West for some students. Just come with us if you want, and you're going to do 2 weeks of BFM. So for 2 weeks, I went with my own instructor and I was doing BFM morning and afternoon. I can tell you at the end, I was pretty damn good at BFM.
Very sharp.
I was sharp. I was young guys from Top Gun, just finishing Top Gun. It was awesome. And there was the British exchange as well, coming from the Tornado. That was also running when he was there 2 years before me, had the same issue. So he knew what I was coming from and what was hard for me. So he was really here to help me out. Russ Martin, he was awesome. So yeah, I had a really great time, like flying north of the parallel, just to make sure we don't infringe in Cuba, and doing BFM over the blue water. That was awesome.
What was for the British guy to discover flying above 30,000 feet?
Yeah, above 30,000 feet. He didn't say about that. He loved the F-18 as well.
Have you done some operations flying the F-18?
No. When I was on the F-18, I was an instructor on the F-18. So I was what they call the RAG at the time I started up, and the FRS by the end. FRS means for Fleet Replacement Squadron. And that was really the transition. So new pilot coming from Meridian becoming a pilot on the F-18, or former F-18 pilot coming back to do a refresher before they're going back to take a CO position or any other position in the squadron. So it's really like it's a round tour for the U.S. Navy. So guys coming from one or two crews, they got time for themselves for 2 or 3 years at the FRS. Take care of the new and take care of the family. So that's what I was doing.
How was it to fly and to land on those boats compared to the French Charles de Gaulle?
Well, the boat is definitely bigger. The big difference is on the landing. On the carrier, the French carrier, you're never going to see yourself above the deck. You're going to be flying the ball, and you're going to be surprised by the impact. Or on the American carrier, it's big enough that you're going to pass the bow of the carrier. You're going to see some gray below you, gray of the deck, and then you're going to touch. You're not going to get this feeling on the French carrier. When it's VFR, I will say it's the same as the French Navy. There's no difference, really. The only thing is the ability to catch shot and trap at the same time. We can't do that on the French Navy. The French carrier is too small, so either you launch or you recover, but you don't do both at the same time, which is some issue after that for safety and stuff like that. They can do that, so downside, there are more the waves are way bigger, so they got more people to recover. So you have to be really head on the swivel when you're doing that. Now, when it's IFR or night, that's where the big difference is, because they got multiple type of pattern to recover.
Yeah, I guess it was a very good experience being embedded in the U.S. Navy.
Yeah, it was awesome. I did my division lead, and my last flight was a 4VX. I had four Hornet with me, two Super Hornet, two Hornet. I was on the Hornet because I wasn't clear on the Super Hornet as a French. And against me, I had four F5, four Hornet, and two Super Hornet for only one X for myself.
From Virginia Beach, you were sent back to France, flying back the Super at that time to have some commanding responsibilities.
The goal for me was to come back on the Rafale.
Yeah.
As all the other exchange before me and after me, I'm the only guy who did the Hornet and didn't come back on the Rafale in the French Navy. But they wanted me to come back as the DCO of the squadron right away, as they were starting to struggle with some pilots. So they sent me back to the 70F. There were still two Super E squadron at this time. The 12F on Rafale was starting to get divided to get the Rafale Standard 2 coming in. So they were starting to do some air to ground. They were at the edge of it to be ready to do that. But Super E at this time was still the big aircraft basically for the French Navy, as the Rafale was only air to air.
Mm-hmm.
So they sent me back on the DCO of the 17F. And I did 2 years of DCO on 17F. First year was a training squadron year. So I was DCO on the training squadron, get back all my qualification, get my division lead qualification back as well in the French Navy. Started to be also the test pilot for the squadron, as I was starting to be one of the guys with the most hour on the Super E at this point. And then went the next year, 2010, September 2010, we were supposed to go back to Afghanistan, and we went back to Afghanistan. So 2010 to 2011 was a hard year for the family, because we left in October for Afghanistan, and I did 20 missions over there. And now, as I was more experienced, I was able to do CAS mission as a lead. I didn't drop. I did some short force, but once again, right when they were there, they restricted the AOE. On my first mission, they wanted me to drop. The British SIS were on the ground. They were trying me very, very hard to drop on the compound, but we were not allowed at the French at the compound to shoot on the compound. So I had to decline it. Anyway, that was Afghanistan, some show of force, and a pretty good time. And we went back in February from Afghanistan. A little bit of anti-piracy work as well on the way back. And then was 1 week in. My CO was skiing, and the base CO called me and said, "Look, so what do you need to go on the carrier for Libya?" So, "I don't know. Did you ask Stan?" That was my CO. "So I can't reach him. Yeah, I need the insert now." I say, "Okay, well," I'd say, "well, the same thing we just came back to." And and then you say, "Okay, I got it. So 12 aircraft, and you're going back with everything." Finally got my CO, and I said, "I just said that." He said, "Oh, you did good. That's what we need." And he was happy. And 1 week after, we were back in the carrier, 21st of March, I think. 23rd of March was the first mission from the carrier with Rafale.
How long have you been resting in France?
1 week. Yeah, 1 week. We did a year on the carrier. So we went back at that, and we stayed until August.
It's a nightmare family-wise.
Yes. Yeah, no, it was rough. When we came back, you feel like a stranger at home a little bit for a while, for sure. Was interesting, though. And then I was able to drop.
But, yeah, finally.
Finally. There was some moment, yeah. I did, out of the 6 months, I think I did 5 months. I only did, at some point, we were too many night pilot, as I was way more experienced than most of the guy. My CO sent me back for 1 month in June, and I went back early July on board, and then he was able to get. So I was able actually to be in charge of the squadron for a month at war. In July to the end of the carrier deployment.
We worked together because I was in the Poggio Renatico headquarters at the time for this operation. But can you just describe the Libyan operation for us?
When we arrive, we're supposed to do the enforcement of the air superiority over Libya, make sure that nobody's flying over. But pretty quickly, I will say in a week, it became we need to make sure that we stop also the mercenaries that Gaddafi was using to stop them, basically to disrupt the population, to attack the population. And as a pilot, as a fighter pilot, that was an amazing time, for sure. And a lot of responsibilities went with it.
For us in the headquarters, it was awesome as well, because the coalition had some drones, some UAVs flying in Libya, and we had the live feed from the UAVs, and we were able to see all the strikes, and as well, we were just next to Cowboy, and we had the holders in live, and it was very full of listeners along with the red card holder that was just beside us. So yeah, it was very nice operation at that time. Then from the Super E, you've chosen to come back on the Air Force side, going to Royal Canadian Air Force. Very surprising, it's not the standout curriculum. Can you talk a little bit about why, first of all, and what's the procedure to move to the RCAF, and what's flying the Hawk as well?
The way it works is, like I say, I wanted to go back to the Rafale. I didn't, because of the Navy choice, so I went to the Super E. The issue I had with that is, basically, after my CO tour, the chance for me to have another flying job in the Navy would have been the CAG position, carrier group position, commander. And by the time I will be in the rank enough to do that, there will only be a Rafale. So I would have been a has-been if I was coming back on that. Not very proficient on the aircraft. Pretty sure I would have been able to make it, but I wouldn't be as useful if I have already been a Rafale pilot. And I really wanted to keep flying, to be honest. And the Navy side, I used to love it. But after my year in 2010 to 2011, I really didn't want to go back and sell for another year on the carrier. And most of the position I would have been able to perform operationally would have been on the carrier for sure as a former fighter.
Yeah.
So I tried to avoid that. So that was... That's the main reason. The Navy never really understand that I needed to get a qualification on the Rafale to be able to stay and to at least keep flying. So I left. So why the aircraft? So first of all, you need to find a place I want you to fly. At this time, 2012, 2014, Air France in France wasn't hiring. So there was no way I'm going to go into the civilian life at this point. I didn't have all my, I already got all my qualification for the JAR, so I could have go into an airline, but I didn't see myself, after a commanding tour to go into a regional, not because there is any, I'm too snob for that, just that it was, the lifestyle that I was hoping for wasn't there at this point. So I really wanted to keep flying fighters. So the aircraft was actually interesting pretty quickly by the American background. And they offered me a position over there. Then came the second part, the hardest one, to make sure the wife is going to be happy to follow. And, yeah. I was lucky enough, and she wanted to come as well. Not very, very happy of it, but she was willing to try it. And kids wasn't any issue. My son, the older one, is like me, was a hockey player since he was three. Since starting to play in the US, so he was more than happy to go to the Canada. And my daughter was too young at this point to have anything to say about that, I think, and she doesn't regret it now. So that's why we moved to Canada. In Canada, my first position I was offered when I arrived was on the Hawk as a training instructor. So for me, it was coming back to my my first aircraft, kind of. The T-45, as a T-45 and the CT-155 are the same aircraft, except one can go on the carrier, and the other one, the CT-155, the Canadian one, is slightly lighter. But inside, really, there's no really big difference. Same type of avionics, everything is ready to go for the F-18, trying to prepare the kids for the F-18. So, yeah, I was coming back to an old aircraft that I knew, and I was quick to adapt. And the Hawk is flying like a Super E. And by that, I mean, you still need to trim, which is a big difference from an F-18 or Rafale or Mirage 2000, is that you need to trim those aircraft. And so coming from the Super E, that was an issue. And this, everything is the same, the way it flies when you fight, the rumbling because of the stalling of the wings. The aircraft is telling you that it's stalling before it actually is stalling. It's not like a fly-by-wire aircraft that's going to do its things to make sure you keep on flying. So you can feel the aircraft. So it's actually pretty fun to do. I did my conversion, and right away, it's only 5 hours in Moose Jaw to do your conversion. They deem after 5 hours as an experienced pilot, you know how to fly the jet. And then you go back to Cold Lake, and Cold Lake is a fighter leading in squadron, we're actually teaching the basic tactics before going to the Hornet. So what we try to achieve is not really teaching any very, very accurate tools. We're teaching the definition of the tools, how they can apply to a hawk, and just to see if the kids can actually cope with the learning curve that's going to be required for F-18 after. Exercise will going to be from 1v1, 2v1, then they do some intercept with a GCI. Then they go back to the air-to ground, they do some bombing, simulated. They don't drop anything here, they just simulate the bombing, the guns, and then they go back to a little bit what they're going to be, they will be doing at the end of their F-18. It's the self-escort strike. Basically, you simulate, you have your fight your way in, all the way to drop your bombs, find your target and drop your bombs, and fight your way out in air-to-air environment and 2v1 environment, basically.
Then you've decided to try to go to the commercial side of the aviation. Can you come back on how did you do that? How did you prepare yourself to the assessments? And how did you join finally Air Canada, that is now your employer?
So 2018, I did my TPL, Canadian TPL. The way I did it kind of weird, but I went through the US first to get my TPL, and I made a conversion to the Canadian one. So that's the beauty of North America, is once you get the FAA qualification, you can change it to a Transport Canada qualification very easily. And you can do the other way around also, but it's harder. I think it is harder than this way. Anyway, so with the ATPL in my pocket and the idea to leave now the Canadian forces as a regular force, try to do something else, I went to ask Encore, which is the regional for WestJet first. It was my first interview. Went well. I didn't have anything to prepare it. I just went the best I can and be as honest as I can. And then I went to, had the chance in November 2017 to do the interview with Air Canada. So what did I prep for Air Canada? First, have a good logbook, very well maintained. And for me, that wasn't easy because I did the French Navy. I did the a little bit of French Air Force, the French Navy, the Canadian Forces. So basically, I had five different type of flight of logbook. So what I did, I took months of my life just to type back all my flight in one electronic logbook. So I will recommend to do that, making sure you have something nice and sturdy, so you can actually present something clear, but still keep your old logbook with the signatures and make sure they are all signed, because they're going to be looking at it. At least Air Canada, they looked at it when I went for the interview. So I did that. And then I also prepped myself for what they call the behavioral question. So behavioral questions, I don't know if it's somewhere else. I mean, I know for Air Canada, I know Delta also is doing that, but it's a very, very specific type of question. I.e., they ask you to talk to me about one day that you have to not respect the SOP. That would be one of the questions they may ask. And in that case, you need to find an example of your previous life. You need to make sure you present the fact that those facts and your experience is responding to the question. And then you need to make sure that at the end you do a sum up and what you will do next time if you have to do it again. So those behavioral questions are the key point here, because they're going to make sure that you're able to, I will say, organize your mind when you're answering a question. And they're really looking at that. It's not really the experience that you have, but it's the way you organize your answer that they're going to be looking at. Also, they also look a lot at the way you present. And I got some insight that you want to get when you're going to go to the interview, make sure you shave and you wear a tie. You will be surprised how many people come up unshaved and without a tie to those type of interview, and you don't reflect well. And when they have to select between 60 pilots every week for only 10 position, you're not going to make the cut if you don't do that.
Yeah, every detail counts.
Every detail counts, yes. Now, unlike France, I will say North America, they love the fighter pilot. I know it's true in the US because a lot of my friends are actually flying for airline coming from the US Navy. And I know they love those. They love the experience. They actually get credit for the experience on the fighters. They do the same in Canada, and that's great. So they really love the experience of the fighters. And if you start to talk about fighters in the interview and what you leave as a fighter pilot, they're going to love it. As long as you're answering the question, the behavioral question, you can use everything you used in your life previous time, even if it's fighter work.
Yeah, it's the same in the UK. I've done 2 or 3 assessments for a couple of initially wet lease company and a major low-cost company. And yeah, it's exactly the same type of questions. And they do like the fighter pilots as well. If you say that you come from the fighter aviation, they will say, okay, yeah, very nice. I was as well in the military, blah, blah, blah. And then you just begin the talks. And that's very nice and very easy to just to share a bit of experience, and they like it.
Yes, definitely. They also want to look at your ability to behave with other people. So if you're able to quickly, I would say, respond to a question, quickly get back, because you're going to spend a lot of time flying after that with a captain. And they don't want somebody that's going to stay on his side, not talking and being an asshole in the cockpit. So they're going to be looking at that also in the interview. If you're open, if you're open mind, if you are ready to answer questions, if you're able to have some joke, practical joke, even when you're doing an interview, they love that. One of the jokes I was told that happened is one of my former students, which is French-Canadian from the French Navy, was one of my students on the Super E. He became Rafale pilot. He left and he entered Air Canada actually 6 months before me. He told me a funny one. They asked him a question was, so you have to divert because the weather is not good. And when you land somewhere, you just realize that the jet is not good to go anymore. What will be your reaction? And as a good fighter, French Navy fighter pilot, he said, am I going to stay long? And the guy starting to not very happy of the question. He said, oh, you don't know. And he say, well, the first thing is I'm going to go out and start to buy some underwear if I'm going to have to stay longer, so we can go out after that and have a lunch and a dinner. And the guy started to laugh. So that's what he was looking for, somebody that's not complaining, but ready to, well, live with it and be proactive to help the company.
Good. So then you joined Air Canada. You flew Airbus and Boeing types. Lucky you.
Well, it's funny you say that. Like, I mean, Airbus, first of all, Air Canada's got some old Airbus, like a first generation of Airbus 320. So it's really a computer aircraft. So there's a lot of tweak or a lot of knowledge to know to be very, very proficient on your Airbus, because all the RNAV approach, for example, it's not going to be that easy with those old aircraft. Yeah. You're mainly going to do some ILS, basically. Mm-hmm. So it's a good aircraft. It's flying well. It's really flying like a... I flew the A400M when it came here. It's flying the same. Like, yeah, it's doing everything for you. When everything is working, the A320 is awesome. But I hate... I have to say, I hate the way you land. The flare with the A320 is a bitch. With this retard, and then you go idle, and you don't really know what's going to happen, and you reverse to the ground, to the direct low for the stick. You never know what's going to happen when you flare with this aircraft. When it's automatic, it's awesome, but when you have to do it actually on an everyday basis, it's... I hope I'm not going to break the aircraft.
Yeah, I bet. Flying the A330, it's pretty the same, except that you are even higher when you do flare, and the A330 is a glider. It's a massive glider.
Yeah, so that's, I mean, flying is good. Yeah, you can put your tray for your food when you're doing a long distance, so that's nice. But the flying portion of it, it's actually, I don't enjoy flying the A320 when you got stick on the... You end on stick and throttle. Even the throttle, you never move it on this freaking A320. I don't like that. You have no muscle memory of where your throttle should be if you have to revert manually. Lucky enough, it doesn't happen very often. But still, I don't really like that. I mean, coming from my background where you can feel the throttle moving all the time on the Super E, even on auto throttle.
Yeah.
that's kind of weird. And then I went to the 737 MAX, and I loved it. I love this aircraft. It's whole as shit. And by old, I mean the old-fashioned way. But you still need to trim. You still need to move the throttle. And but when you land, because you trim, because you feel your aircraft, it's actually landing pretty nicely. Yeah. I love to land it.
So you flew the 737 MAX. Did you fly the 800 before the MAX?
No. Air Canada only have MAX.
Only MAX. So you flew the MAX. Did you have any issue? Because everybody knows that there is major issue with the MAX that is grounded right now. And they are still dealing with the problems. And with the COVID-19 crisis, it's going to be worse at the time. Then did you have any issue with that? It's not fly-by-wire, but with this flight control software?
No, I really never encountered any issue. Like I said, I really love the flight of the MAX. Not saying that because I'm a MAX flyer, that's it for the moment. But it was, I never had any issue. Really, it's flying well. And it's, I didn't know that it can go that bad, honestly. Yeah. I wasn't in the cockpit of those poor guys that got those issues. We did some practice in the simulator, but we cannot replicate it at this time when we were doing it. But it's a damn, because it's it was so easy to fly. You just you park the throttle and you fly it manually. You trim your aircraft and it's flying by itself, and it's very, very steady, very, very nice, very smooth to fly. It was flying well for me. Yeah.
Okay. Well. Now you guys that are flying the 737 MAX, that were flying the 737 MAX, you are grounded now. What do you do right now? You just are you transitioning to the to another fleet, or you just wait for the 737 MAX to bounce back?
For me, I could have bid something else if I wanted to, but I'm also doing the air reserve, so I'm still doing the military side. So I'm flying on the Hawk still, and I'm still instructing. And also one of the reasons is my flying is actually pretty interesting, as I'm Vancouver based. So my flying at Vancouver, Hawaii, and all the islands. So that's the only thing I'm doing.
Oh, yeah.
And I love my flying, to be honest. So if I can get it back when it's back up, I would love to do that again.
Yeah. Hawaii flight should be very nice.
It is. It's an ETOPS flying first. So being on a narrow body and be able to do some ETOPS flying, it's not everybody that can do that. And also you're going each time to Maui or Kauai or Island or Oahu. It's pretty cool.
Very nice flights. Very nice flights.
And you still do also some nice flying inside Canada and North America. You still have some awkward San Diego or San Francisco or LA, sometimes Mexico, and some rotation with Calgary and Edmonton. But it's not very often. But to fly all over the Rockies and the Sierra Nevada, it's not an issue. I really rather fly in the West Coast than to fly on the East Coast of the of North America.
Yep.
East Coast is way flatter, less things to see. But the West Coast with all the mountains is so beautiful. You're never going to be fed up with that.
Yeah, you can't. And it looks like being very beautiful. So you told us previously, but you are now in the reserve flying for the RCF. Do you have any special agreements with right now? I don't think so, because your schedule is pretty free. But did you have any special agreements between Air Canada and RCAF?
It's not an agreement. It's the Air Canada allow people to fly on the site as long as you're not flying for any other commercial airline. Basically, you just have to be sure that you don't infringe in your the maximum of flying you can do per month, or the maximum of sectors you do every month. So that's the advantage of the fighters. Is fighters, I mean, you fly for an hour and 30 minutes maybe. We don't do tanking on the Hawk, so it's a very short flight. And you do what, 1-2 flights a day maybe? So when you do 5 or 7 days of a month of reserve, it's never going to be more than 10 hours. So actually, to get max out on your flight time, it's going to be pretty hard. Especially also in Canada, because in Canada we can do more than usual. There's new rules coming in, but it used to be we can do all the way to 1,200 hours per month per year, compared to 1,000 for everybody else.
Yeah, okay. So we've seen together your a very long career flying for the French Navy, for the US Navy, for the Royal Canadian Air Force, and for Air Canada. Right now, do you have any major lessons learned?
I won't say there is a best to fly than anything else. So everything for me is fun to fly. That's the first thing. The life on the carrier was awesome. I mean, I'm pretty sure I could say that was my best part of my life, but I was also younger, so who knows? but the life on the carrier was awesome, to be able to be every day with your buddies and flying every day as a fighter with your buddies. There's nothing else to do. That was a great time. The flying was awesome. It was hard, but it was awesome. Being able to fly a little bit of everywhere in the world. I flew in low level in Saudi Arabia, Djibouti, and I mean, everything that the Air Force is doing, plus slightly more because we have the chance in the carrier going everywhere, Greece, Italy, even India. That's a good part. Now, there were some downsides. You were far away from the home, far away from the family, and at some point you're starting to get bored as well. So with the when you look at it afterwards, that was awesome. But quickly after I come the year, I was far away from the family all the time. It was tough for them. It's tough to be far. So it was good to go to the Canadian Forces after that. Canadian Forces, I mean, that was a new experience for me to teach, and to teach not from the outside of the aircraft, but to teach from the inside of the aircraft. Because Super E, I was teaching on it, but you're the leader you're teaching your wingman. There's no dual seat. So to have to teach from inside of a cockpit was a new stuff for me. How do you do a BFM with a guy, not overriding him or not overwhelming him by giving some information all the time? He needs to make his mistakes and need to be able to capitalize on that so he can learn. Mm-hmm. But you don't want to be making some too much mistakes, so he's going to kill himself as well and kill yourself at the same time. So yeah. That was interesting. I still like it. I found out that I was more an operational guy than a teacher guy. I love to do it. I think I'm not that bad at doing it either. But in my heart, I was more an operational guy. I'd rather be in the operation. And then you come the moving to the airline. And for a lot of fighter guys, they say, okay, I don't want to drive a bus. I don't want to be a bus driver. So I never got this idea. For me, that was learning a new mission, learning a new work. And I actually enjoy it. And the max being done, I miss my job. I really miss it right now. I'm still flying the Hawk. I'm still doing some pretty good stuff. I'm able to do aerobatics, fighting, stuff like that. But I miss my my Vancouver, Hawaii. It's another work, but I love it. I really love it. It's not the same flying. It's not about performance and being upside down. But it's still flying, and it's pretty cool.
Yeah, I think it's... We are very lucky to be able to have a job that we do enjoy. Flying is very enjoyable. Yeah, we are very lucky to miss flying, to miss going to work. And that's not in mind of everybody. What do you have left in your aviation bucket list?
The seaplane. I did one trip of seaplane in Biscarrosse when I was a CEO. And we did this... this participation with the city, and the mayor was kind enough to offer me a tour in the seaplane in Biscarrosse. And I found it very, very, I find it very great, especially for a Navy guy. It's the epitome of
back everything. To the basics.
Yeah, it's everything. It's being on the sea, being on your aircraft, taking off from the water, going back on the water. I loved it. So I need to get this quote. So that will be my next trip. I don't think I'm going to make it a living out of it, but if I can, I'd love for my old days to be able to get this qualification and living in Canada. It's part of the background here to be able to go island from island.
Yeah, exactly. You have such huge opportunities to fly floodplanes in Canada. So you should be able to enjoy it. What's next for you now?
Next for me will be Max going back to fly, so we can train on that. Normally when he's going back, he should be full up with the HUD, so we're gonna get HUD on both sides. That would be interesting to fly this aircraft with a HUD. Well, that's one of the things, the A320, if he had a HUD, it will be a perfect aircraft.
Yeah, the Neo they have.
Yeah, it makes sense. The fly-by-wire with you need a HUD with a fly-by-wire. That's my, as a fighter pilot, that will be my recommendation for any companies in the world. If you want to buy a fly-by-wire aircraft, you need to buy a HUD with it. If it doesn't have the HUD, you're not doing it right. But the SMAX, it's not a fly-by-wire. You really need one? I don't think so, but that's still going to be nice.
Comfortable for all the LVO's operations as well.
Exactly. So I'm looking for it. And then the upgrade. Hopefully the COVID-19 is not going to shut down my game plan. But I'm on the lease for Captain in January next year. So hopefully it will stay that way and be able to go as a captain to Hawaii next time.
Yeah, that's very, very nice as a game plan. So, Luxor, thank you very much for coming here. It was a pleasure having you on this podcast. I know you don't have right now very busy schedule, but I wish you very nice flights with Air Canada flying the MAX. And see you.
And see you. Thank you very much, Mathieu. Bye.
You've been listening to the 90s Podcast, an aviation podcast. You can follow us on Instagram on the 90s Podcast account. Click on the link for any inquiry. Thank you for listening again. And fly safe.